A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
My Weird Prompts is a community-driven initiative exploring how AI can fuel curiosity and uncover the fascinating ways our world works. GPU compute for this podcast is generously provided by Modal. Learn more at modal.com.
Have you ever had that feeling when you start a new documentary series on a Friday night, and by the second hour, you realize you have seen the same three drone shots of a misty forest about 15 times? It is that specific exhaustion where you are checking the progress bar, realizing there are still 4 episodes left, and the story has barely moved past the initial hook. You are sitting there staring at the next episode button, and instead of feeling excitement, you feel a sense of mounting obligation. It is like the streaming service is assigning you homework rather than offering you an insight into the world.
It is the classic case of a 90-minute story trapped in a 6-hour body. Herman Poppleberry here, and I have spent a lot of time lately looking into the mechanics of this. Today's prompt from Daniel is about the art of documentary filmmaking and specifically how we navigate this era of docu-bloat to find the high signal content that actually justifies its runtime. We are living in a golden age of access, but a dark age of curation.
It is funny you call it docu-bloat. Daniel mentioned that even as a huge fan of the genre, he is feeling the hit-and-miss nature of it lately. There is this sense that the Netflixification of the medium has created a subgenre where quantity is prioritized over the actual density of information. Why is that happening? Is it just the algorithm demanding more minutes, or is there something more structural at play in how these things are produced now? It feels like we have traded the sharp edge of investigative journalism for the soft padding of lifestyle content.
It is a combination of factors, but the economics of the streaming era are the primary driver. In the old days of theatrical documentaries or even cable television, you were often constrained by a physical slot or a specific theatrical cut. If a film was 2 hours long, it had to be incredible to hold a theater audience. But today, the primary metric for a streaming platform is often the completion rate mixed with total hours watched. If a platform can get you to watch 6 hours of content instead of 90 minutes, that is a massive win for their engagement data. It keeps you on the platform longer, which reduces churn.
But if the completion rate drops because people get bored, does that not hurt them? I have read that for some of these 6-part series, the completion rate after episode 2 can be under 40%. That seems like a failure if the goal is to actually tell a story. If 60% of your audience is jumping ship before the halfway point, you have lost the narrative thread entirely.
You would think so, but the initial sign-up or the initial click is often what the marketing team cares about. They want the big, buzzy, true crime hook that dominates the social media conversation for a weekend. By the time you realize the middle 4 episodes are just filler and repetitive interviews, they have already captured your attention for the period that matters most to their trending charts. It is a shift from truth-seeking as the primary goal to content-filling. They are looking for a return on investment that is measured in minutes, not in the depth of the revelation.
It feels like the sincerity threshold we talked about back in episode 1171. We discussed how we can forgive a movie for being spectacular in its failure if it feels sincere. But these bloated documentaries often feel cynical. They feel like they are intentionally wasting the viewer's time because they have a quota to fill. When a filmmaker is sincere, they are trying to communicate something vital. When a platform is just filling a slot, that sincerity evaporates.
That is a great connection. When a documentary is padded, it loses its soul. It becomes a product rather than a piece of journalism or art. One of the biggest offenders is the way they handle information. You will see a piece of evidence revealed at the end of episode 1, then episode 2 starts with a 5-minute recap of that same evidence, followed by 3 different talking heads saying the exact same thing in slightly different ways. It is the visual equivalent of a high school student increasing the font size and margins on a term paper to hit a page count. They are not adding depth, they are adding surface area.
So, how does the editing suite contribute to this? We looked at the idea of editing as a form of puppetry in episode 1187, where the editor is essentially creating a collaborative hallucination with the audience, in a bloated documentary. Does the editor become a sort of unwilling accomplice in stretching the narrative? Are they using their skills to manufacture tension, where the raw footage provides none?
They absolutely do. Modern non-linear editing software makes it incredibly easy to keep everything. Back when people were cutting physical film, every cut was a commitment. You had to be precious with your footage because you were physically destroying and reassembling a medium. Now, you can just keep dragging clips onto the timeline. There is also this trend of the dramatic recreation, which is often used as pure filler. If you do not have the actual footage of the event, you just hire some actors to walk around in shadows for 40 minutes. It adds zero informational value, but it fills the visual space while a narrator slowly reads a court transcript. It is a way of creating the illusion of a scene without the substance of a discovery.
It is the difference between a film like Free Solo, which is incredibly tight and focused on a single high-stakes narrative, and some of these recent true crime series where they spend 3 hours interviewing the neighbor of the cousin of the person involved. Free Solo worked because every frame was serving the ultimate goal of showing the climb. There was no room for fluff because the reality of the situation was so dense. You could feel the stakes in every cut.
I agree. The density of information is the key. A great documentary should feel like it is bursting at the seams, where the director had to make painful choices to cut amazing scenes because they did not fit the core arc. In the streaming originals, it often feels like the director was told to go back and find more footage, any footage, to make it an even 4 episodes. They are moving away from the fly-on-the-wall aesthetic where the camera is a witness, and toward a highly formatted aesthetic where the camera is a prop.
So if the mainstream platforms are increasingly leaning into this formatted, bloated style, where does a documentary boffin like Daniel go to find the real gems? If you've seen all the big hits and you are tired of the filler, what is the next level of discovery? How do we find the films that respect our intelligence?
This is where it gets exciting because there is actually a parallel universe of incredible non-fiction content that is thriving precisely because it avoids these tropes. The first place I always point people toward is Mubi. They have a very specific model where they host a curated selection of films, often adding one new one every day and removing another. Because their audience is looking for cinema rather than just content, the documentaries they feature tend to be much more experimental and tightly edited. They are not trying to keep you on the platform for 10 hours. They want you to have a profound 90-minute experience. It is a boutique experience in a world of big-box retailers.
I have noticed that Mubi often feels more like a film festival than a streaming service. It is that sense of curation that is missing from the big giants. But what about the stuff that is more educational or focused on how the world works, which is what Daniel really loves? He is looking for that high-signaled technical depth.
For that, you cannot beat the Criterion Channel. People think of it as just for old black and white foreign films, but their documentary library is staggering. They have the entire Janus Films collection and works from the Maisels brothers and Errol Morris. These are filmmakers who define the genre by being incredibly precise. When you watch something like Salesman or The Thin Blue Line, one realizes how much power there is in a documentary that treats the audience as intelligent. They do not over-explain. They do not use repetitive recaps. They trust you to follow the thread. They understand that silence can be more informative than a celebrity narrator.
There is also Canopy, right? I feel like that is one of the best-kept secrets in the world of high-signal content. I have used it for research before, and the depth of their catalog is almost overwhelming.
Canopy is a miracle. If you have a public library card or a university login, you can access over 30,000 films for free. They specialize in the kind of stuff that is too smart for the big streamers. They have a massive selection of social and political documentaries, ethnographic films, and deep dives into science and technology. Because they are funded through library partnerships rather than a direct subscription model, they do not have the same incentive to bloat their runtimes. They just want to provide high-quality educational material. It is the ultimate resource for someone who wants to understand the mechanics of the world without the fluff.
It is a bit of a paradox, is it not? The services we pay the most for often provide the most diluted content, while the ones that are free or lower cost via libraries are providing the dense, high-value stuff. It reminds me of the genius paradox from episode 1300, where sometimes doing less or having fewer resources leads to a much better final product because it forces you to be precise. When you do not have a massive budget to hire actors for recreations, you have to rely on the strength of your interviews and your archival research.
That is a perfect application of that concept. When you have a limited budget or a limited window of time, you have to be a genius in how you use it. Some of the most profound documentaries ever made were shot on a shoestring. Look at something like The Act of Killing. It is a masterpiece of non-traditional structure. It is long, yes, but every minute is essential because it is building a psychological profile of the subjects that you simply could not get in a shorter format. It is not long because it is padded. It is long because the subject matter is that deep. It challenges the viewer to sit with the discomfort of the narrative. It is the opposite of a snooze-inducing true crime series, because it is actively engaging with the morality of its own creation.
That brings up a good point about Community. How do you find out about something like The Act of Killing before it becomes a massive hit? Where are the communities where people are actually talking about the craft of documentary rather than just the latest true crime scandal?
Letterboxd is actually a huge resource for this if you follow the right people. There are specific users who maintain massive, curated lists of nonfiction films categorized by very niche topics. You can find lists for everything from the history of urban planning to the physics of black holes. The documentary subreddit is also quite active, though you have to filter through the occasional request for the same three series everyone has already seen. But the real high-signal communities are often centered around film festivals.
Most people cannot just fly to Amsterdam for the International Documentary Film Festival, even if they are as big a fan as Daniel is. How do you tap into that energy from home?
You follow the festival's digital presence and look at their award winners. The International Documentary Film Festival Amsterdam, or IDFA, is the biggest in the world. Their website often has a section for their past selections, and they even have a free collection of documentaries you can watch online. Same with Sundance or Hot Docs in Toronto. If you look at what won the jury prizes at these festivals, you are looking at the top 1% of the genre. These are films that have been vetted by experts for their craft, not just their marketability. They have been through a filter that prioritizes storytelling over total hours watched.
So it is about following the curators rather than the algorithms. I like that. It is a more active form of consumption. You are not just sitting there letting the next episode play. You are seeking out the things that have been recognized for their excellence. It turns the viewer from a passive consumer into an active participant in the film's life.
It is the only way to stay sane in the current media landscape. Another great resource is the newsletter, The Documentalist. It is a dedicated deep dive into nonfiction filmmaking that highlights under-the-radar releases and interviews directors about their process. It helps you understand why a certain film was shot the way it was, which adds a whole new layer of appreciation when you actually watch it. It bridges the gap between the casual viewer and the documentary boffin.
We have talked a lot about the platforms and the festivals, but let's get into some practical takeaways for someone like Daniel who wants to filter out the noise. If you are looking at a new documentary on a major platform, what are the red flags that it might be a bloated mess? How do we spot the filler before we commit our evening to it?
My number one rule is the 3-episode rule, but with a twist. If a docuseries is more than 3 episodes long, I immediately look for the director's cut or the festival version. Oftentimes, a director will make a brilliant 90-minute film, and then the streaming platform will buy it on the condition that they expand it into a 4-part series. If you can find the original festival cut, that is almost always the superior version. It is the version that was made before the marketing department got their hands on it.
That is a revealing look at the industry. So the bloat is often added after the fact? Is it a contractual requirement rather than a creative choice?
Frequently, yes. It is a way for the platform to justify the purchase price. Another red flag is the runtime of the individual episodes. If every episode is exactly 52 minutes long, that is a sign of a formatted production. Real life does not happen in 52-minute increments. A documentary that is allowed to have an episode that is 20 minutes long and another that is 80 minutes long is a sign that the director is following the story, not a television grid. It shows that the structure is organic to the material.
I also look at the credits. If there are 15 executive producers and a host of corporate logos at the start, you are looking at a product that has been through a lot of committees. Committees love padding because it feels like they're getting more for their money. They want to see their investment stretched out across as many minutes as possible. The best documentaries usually have a very small, dedicated team. They have a singular vision that has not been diluted by a dozen different stakeholders.
There is also the narrator. If the documentary relies heavily on a celebrity narrator to explain things that the visuals should be showing you, that is often a sign that the footage itself was not strong enough to carry the narrative. The best documentaries often have no narration at all, or they use the voices of the subjects themselves. It is more immersive and usually much more honest. It allows the audience to make their own connections rather than being told what to think by a famous voice.
I think we also need to mention the role of independent distributors like Neon or A24. When they put their name on a documentary, like Fire of Love or Honeyland, it is clear you are getting something that has a distinct point of view. They are looking for theatrical quality, which naturally filters out the bloat. They are betting on the film's ability to move an audience in a dark room, not its ability to keep someone scrolling on their phone.
Honeyland is a perfect example. It is a documentary about a wild beekeeper in North Macedonia. It is incredibly quiet, slow-paced, but not a single second of it feels like filler. It is a masterclass in patient storytelling. It respects the viewer's time by giving them something beautiful and profound to look at, rather than just shouting information at them. It is high signal because every frame is intentional. It does not need a dramatic recreation because the reality of the beekeeper's life is more dramatic than anything you could stage.
It sounds like the advice is to move away from the big box stores of content and find the boutique shops. It takes a bit more effort, but the reward is that you actually learn something and feel moved, rather than just feeling like you have killed a few hours. It is about quality over quantity.
Precisely, and for someone like Daniel, who is technically literate and deeply engaged with how the world works, that effort is part of the fun. It is like being a detective. You find a lead on a great film, you track it down on a niche platform, and then you share it with your community. That is how the art form stays alive. It is a more rewarding way to engage with media.
I want to talk about the future for a second. We are seeing AI start to play a role in every part of media production. Do you think we will see a world where we can have personalized documentary lengths? Like, if I have 30 minutes, can an AI... I trim a 6-hour series down to the high signal parts for me. Or would that destroy the very thing we are looking for?
It is technically possible, but it brings up a lot of ethical questions about the director's intent. If an AI trims a film, is it still the same film? We talked about the strings of code and the art of puppetry in episode 1187. If the AI is pulling the strings, the collaborative hallucination might break. You might get the information, but you would lose the emotional arc. However, I do think AI could be used as a powerful tool for discovery. Imagine an AI that has watched every documentary on Canopy and can recommend a film based on the specific level of technical detail you are looking for. It could help you find that 1-hour film about bridge building that is exactly what you need.
That would be incredible. Instead of an algorithm that wants to keep you watching for hours to serve ads or prevent churn, you have an assistant that wants to find you the most efficient way to understand a complex topic. It turns the model of engagement on its head. It prioritizes the viewer's time over the platform's metrics.
It would move us back toward the idea of the documentary as a tool for enlightenment rather than just another form of entertainment. I think that is what Daniel is looking for, and it is certainly what I look for. We want to come away from a film feeling like our perspective has been shifted, even if just by a few degrees. We want to feel like we have gained a new lens through which to view the world.
So, to wrap this up, if you are a documentary lover, the message is clear. Do not settle for the bloat. Use your library card for Canopy, check out the curation on Mubi and the Criterion Channel, and look to the major film festivals for your reading list. Be an active curator of your own attention.
And do not be afraid to turn it off. If the documentary is not respecting your time, you do not owe it your attention. There is too much incredible work out there to waste it on a series that should have been an email or a 90-minute film. Life is too short for repetitive drone shots and 5-minute recaps.
This has been a great dive into the state of nonfiction. It makes me want to go find a really dense, hour-long doc about something incredibly specific, like the history of specialized bridge building or the physics of deep-sea cables.
I can find you three of those on Canopy before we finish this recording. I will even find you the ones with the fewest executive producers.
I have no doubt. Well, that is our exploration of the documentary landscape. We have gone from the frustrations of DocuBloat to the hidden gems of curated platforms. Hopefully, this gives Daniel and all our listeners a roadmap for finding the good stuff.
It is all about the signal-to-noise ratio. Keep your signal high and your bloat low.
Thanks as always to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for keeping the show running smoothly behind the scenes.
And a big thanks to Modal for providing the GPU credits that power the generation of this show. Their serverless infrastructure is what makes this collaboration possible.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you are finding these deep dives useful, a quick review on your podcast app of choice really helps us reach more people who are looking for high signal content.
You can also find us at myweirdprompts.com for the full archive and all the ways to subscribe.
Until next time, stay curious and keep looking for the truth behind the edit.
Goodbye, everyone.
See ya.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where our thoughts go from slow takes to facts on cue. We change and follow through. My Weird Prompts, that's the close from sloth.